Welcome back. Jim DeRogatis is a person I have known and admired for some time. He is a professor at Columbia College. He's also the co-host with my colleague Greg Kot of the syndicated show Sound Opinions, which talks mostly about music I don't listen to, but I still listen to the show because they are both really lively. One of the courses that Jim has taught at Columbia is a course called Journalism as Literature, and I would have to say that his new book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, one of the most compelling books I have read in as long as I can remember, qualifies as journalism as literature. Jim, I know you're a little under the weather, but I hope that compliment is enough to keep you on the radio for the next hour.
Of course, Rick. For you, anything. And plus, we're going to sound alike.
What? good luck to you. I cannot tell you. I've read the book twice, and the depth of this book, I think a lot of people may think, oh, it's about that guy, R. Kelly, who we heard about or saw on TV or who cried in front of Gail King. This book is so about Chicago. It is about journalism. It is about courts and cops and the church and the failure, I think, of people to stop a monster. You'll accept that I believe this book to exist on a number of different levels. It is hardly Jim DeRogatis just the, hey, R. Kelly's a bad guy and he did this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just a remarkable piece of work. It began sort of when you arrived at the paper, as you write on
the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Yeah.
No one's in the office. You didn't like to go in the office. You came in and you had a bunch of, you know, the free CDs that they send, and there was a fax paper in the days pre-email. Dear Mr. DeRogatis, I'm sending this to you because I don't know where else to go. You wrote about R. Kelly a couple of weeks ago and compared him to Marvin Gaye. Well, I guess Marvin Gaye had problems too, but I don't think they were like Robert's problem. And it's a thing that goes back many years, is young girls. You had heard that kind of whisper on the scene, had you not?
Everybody in Chicago had, especially in the music world. You know, from the beginning of Kelly's career, 1990, 1991, it was always in air quotes, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Robert likes them young. What does that mean? And what does that mean in a field like popular music, where everybody from Frank Sinatra, you know, to the 75-year-old Rolling Stones,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You know, but there was something that had happened in 1994. He produced the debut album by an incredible talent from Detroit, Aaliyah, mm-hmm. who was enrolled at the Detroit School of Performing Arts. You know, she was 15, according to her record company bio.
Right.
Other people were whispering, now she was 18. There was a Cook County marriage certificate signed by David Orr, the Cook County clerk, authenticated. She signed it as an 18-year-old, but she was really 15. That went away. When you think that in the late 50s, Jerry Lee Lewis married his 14-year-old second cousin. Mm-hmm. It was his third marriage,
yeah,
by the way.
Sure.
You know, and it lasted 2 decades, you know.
Well, but there is, Jim.
It destroyed his career, you know. But Kelly dodged that bullet with Aaliyah.
Well, it becomes, I think, and you make such good points in the book about this, is fame and certainly money tend to overshadow or get this kind of general, you know, the sins tend to be forgiven. And especially in his case, because he became kind of symbolic to the black community here because he stayed here when he became famous, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was a huge hero. You know, you were saying before, journalism is literature. I grew up worshiping this idea of new journalism, Tom Wolfe and The Right Stuff and The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Joan Didion, what Truman Capote had done within Cold Blood. And it's a horrifying story. It's one that got its teeth into me, and it's been 19 years. I never stopped because when the phone rings and a young woman is saying, I've been hurt, no one will listen to me. Can I tell you my story? I don't think you're a journalist, much less a human being.
You're not a human being.
Don't,
well, that's
right.
why.
But you know, I think that the reason to write the book, which I never wanted to write,
I know,
is what does this say about the Me Too moment? What does it say about this city that we love, but also occasionally, more than occasionally, hate?
Yeah.
You know, the race, the music industry, this insidious curse of our time.
Yeah.
You know, look at the White House. You know, all you have to do is be a celebrity, be in the spotlight. You can spout anything, do anything, and the great American disease of the moment is this lust for fame, and people let celebrities get away with anything.
Well, and I think, you know, the other thing about it, and you just mentioned the whole Me Too movement and the most, you know, famous author of the Me Too movement, Harvey Weinstein, you know, you make the great point you make in this book as well. And again, the book is Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly, 20 years in the making, and I cannot imagine the energy in the writing, is that if any one of Robert Sylvester Kelly's victims had been a white kid from Wheaton, this would have been vastly different. I mean, that's a hard thing to face, but it is an absolute truth. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it is me repeating what dozens and dozens of black women and men have said. You know, I mean, our job as journalists and broadcasters, you and me, is to give a megaphone to those people who are not being heard. And, you know, they have said to me, and I have simply repeated it, nobody matters less in our society than young black girls. His victims were invisible. And yet, what was astounding, Rick, from the beginning, when I started reporting with Abdon Palish, who was the court's reporter in the fall of 2000, you know, 3 out of 4 African-American women we met on the West Side or the South Side told us a story of this guy cruising Whitney Young High School, Kenwood Academy, the Rock and Roll McDonald's on Clark Street, Evergreen Plaza Shopping Mall. You know, and if it wasn't firsthand, it was their cousin, their auntie, their sister, their best friend, their teammate on the basketball team. It is now, I would say, literally 4 out of 4 black women. I mean, I've gone and done TV interviews and radio interviews, and the producer will say, I saw him, I had a story, he was at this nightclub, my friend disappeared. Or the security guard, or I'm stopped on the street. It was never a secret. This was a monster in the midst of the black community, but black men of power and influence, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, the Reverend James Meeks, the Black Congressional Caucus booked him to do a fundraiser. He was named Grand Marshal of the Bud Billiken Parade, you know, 5 or 6 years after he was acquitted on making child pornography. You know, no one wanted to believe their sisters, their aunts, their wives.
Well, you
their
talk
daughters.
About, you know, one of the concepts, and I hope you can stand. If you really feel bad, you can
call up.
We got to take like some commercial breaks. But I want to talk. You talk about the. I want to right after this commercial. I want to talk about R. Kelly's life, which I think one thing that has been kind of ignored in many of the quick interviews you've had in print and in on television. There have been a number of them. Some have been quite good, but they've been short. Is, you know, you tell me, I'm a Chicagoan, you give me such an accurate and in some ways haunting portrait of who this guy was. Where, I could go on the street right now and ask 100 people where R. Kelly came from and what his childhood was like, and not one of them would be able to tell me. You do a remarkable job of detailing that. I want to talk about that, if you would, when we come back from a short commercial break. I'm talking with Jim DeRogatis, the author of Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. It is dedicated, marvelously, it is dedicated for the girls. We'll be back in a couple minutes. I have in front of me a heavily underlined and noted copy of Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. I will take the the little notes out of it after this radio show. I am interviewing the author of this remarkable book, Jim DeRogatis, who has spent 19 years since getting a fax at the office telling him there was something wrong with this R. Kelly. Before we get into the background in R. Kelly's life, which in many ways, Jim, I'll be really honest with you, the way parts of his background make me almost sad. I'll just tell you that. You do not paint him as a born monster, but a man who became, I think, a monster. You only met him once, in person once, in January 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And then a while later, you talked at length, 8 months later, and there's some, you quote him, and this paragraph is haunting to me. You write, Jim DeRogatis does, as we were wrapping up, Kelly told me he'd enjoyed our conversation and he wanted to add one more thing. Quote, "This is called show business. What I do in my music is what I feel, not necessarily how I am. I don't walk around with my pants down all day saying, 'Give me a girl.' People need not to judge what they see on TV. Nobody knows Robert," and that's amazing. He always talked in the third person, "or what he's been through. Not R. Kelly, but Robert R. Kelly is a thing on TV." Okay. You do an amazing job of detailing who this kid was. Who was this kid who grew up to be famous and monstrous?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's a kid from the South Side with everything that's great about the South Side.
Mm-hmm.
Extended family, you know, basketball games, backyard barbecues. He has the breaks. He gets to go to Kenwood Academy.
Yep.
There was also a lot of horror in those houses where he lived. There was sexual abuse by an older member of the family. His half-brother, Carrie Kelly, has since said it was their older sister. There were four siblings, three boys and a girl. They were all of different fathers. Mm. You know, there's also abuse by an older man, either an actual relative or somebody that they called uncle. You know, Kelly writes about some of this in his autobiography, immodestly titled Solar Coaster, My Diary of Me.
And which, when you first mentioned that book, you mentioned one of your great inspirations, the great critic Lester Bangs, who told you at one point, rock and roll comes down to myth. There are no facts. and then you write, from the beginning, Kelly excelled at building the myth. You know, you talk about the book by David, co-authored, I suppose, but David Ritz, who's written 36 Told to Celebrities, and a good one about Marvin Gaye. But this book is to be looked at with great suspicion, I would have to say.
I mean, there's buildings that don't exist, addresses that don't exist, streets that don't intersect. He seems to have simply let his tape recorder run.
Yeah.
There was no reporting, no fact-checking. In fact, Ritz brags about that. He says, "My role is to just tell the artist's story the way they want to tell it. And when it's as complicated as R. Kelly's, you are obviously missing 9/10 of the story." You know, the man who was a victim became a victimizer.
Absolutely.
And all of the mental health professionals I've talked to, the experts on sexual abuse, have said that many victims grow up to become champions of other victims trying to stop this, and some become victimizers themselves. I hate armchair psychology.
I know.
The people that I interviewed are people who work with sexual abuse in young black girls in Chicago, one of whom, Dr. Charmaine Jake Matthews, went to high school with Kelly, Kenwood Academy.
Mm-hmm.
He made 1 year before he was kicked out for the inability to read or write. Another, Dr. Sharon Cooper, was set to testify at his trial. She's a brilliant African-American from the South who travels the world, really the world's foremost authority on sexual abuse of minors. And Judge Vincent Gaughan, during that trial in 2008.
Oh, there's a guy we have to talk about. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a piece of work. I mean, there's a special place in hell for that man.
Yep.
And I feel incredibly vindicated 2 weeks ago Thursday, you know, in black and white, in the federal indictments, 18 new charges from the Southern District of New York and the Northern District of Illinois. The feds have got him. He's never going to breathe fresh air again. You know, he bribed the girl in the videotape in the 2008 trial, her mother and her father, the witnesses who couldn't be bribed to lie to the grand jury or lie in their court testimony or refuse to testify, were threatened physically. And there it is now in black and white. It reads, Rick, you know, I'm a student of pop music. I'm a critic. I'm a historian. Never in the history of popular music, which has a century of men mistreating women.
No question.
Has anybody been hit with criminal charges so extensive? Well, nobody.
Let me ask you about when you and Abdon, you were paired with Abdon, the bright editor, Don Hainer, among them at the Sun-Times, said, look, this is maybe bigger than music. And you and Abdon, who form one of the most unlikely, but to my mind, one of the cutest pairs of reporters I've ever known. I know and respect Abdon tremendously. What was that like? You were getting into territory, and I don't just mean the physical territory. I mean the legal territory that was unfamiliar to you, and both of you were getting into parts of town that many or most white reporters never go to. You were attempting to get interviews. You were attempting to get the goods on this guy. How was that for you? It must have been a comfort for both of you to have one another. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's always an asset to work as part of a team. I think an asset we had as white reporters is we were not afraid to ask stupid questions.
Exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Sure.
You know, we were clearly not part of these people's communities. On the other hand, as a music critic, you know, there's this instant bonding. You know, a woman is playing who's about to talk about the harm done to someone she loves, you know, her daughter, is playing Mavis Staples. I've interviewed Mavis Staples. You've interviewed Mavis. Suddenly we're cousins, right?
Right.
You know,
right.
I had that ability. Abdon had the, you know, slow, methodical legal affairs reporter mentality. But I'll tell you, Rick, with one notable exception, and that's a fascinating story, there was no one who slammed their door in our face. We were invited into people's living rooms. We were given tea. We had people crying on our shoulders, showing us literally the scars on their wrists from where they tried to kill themselves after sexual contact with Kelly that began at age 15, ends at age 18. We've wanted to tell our story. No one has been willing to listen.
You guys,
I guess the two exceptions were the girl in the videotape, and now we know why.
Right.
It's in black and white, federal indictment. She was paid off. That makes it sound benign. The most horrifying testimony during the trial was an assistant of Kelly's said he would see the mother and the father bring their 14-year-old daughter to R. Kelly's studio with an overnight bag.
With an overnight bag, and a pillow. And pajamas and a pillow.
And leave her for the night.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she was pipped out. And then there was, I believe, another underage victim that's not named. There are 10 underage victims between the two indictments from the federal courts in New York and Chicago. I believe one is a relative of the girl in the videotape who was a year younger. And we did ring that doorbell, and it was a really impressive mansion in a South Side suburb.
Yep.
And the language that came from that father, but 99% of the doorbells we rang, people wanted to tell this story. And the most common thing we heard was not, I hate that SOB. It was again and again and again. Brother needs help.
Yeah,
brother's got to stop.
Yeah.
He's got a problem.
That haunts me, too.
And, you know, people admired that from this tough upbringing, and that wasn't clear until years later,
right,
the sexual abuse. But from this tough upbringing, he can't read, he can't write. He's busking on the L platforms and in the Viagra Triangle, right?
Yeah.
Busking for change. He becomes the dominant voice in R&B of two generations.
Yeah.
You know, he has outsold every artist Chicago's ever produced. You name them. Curtis Mayfield or the Smashing Pumpkins.
And I'll tell you, and even so, Jim, even at the time, another point you bring up remarkably in this soulless case against R. Kelly, for a large time, 90% of Chicago wouldn't have recognized him if he walked down the street. We got to take a break.
He was a black superstar, yeah.
Yeah, but that again is one of the fascinating elements of your book. I mean, you make the point that Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey had sort of crossed over and being African-American to some other kind of realm. We got to take a commercial break. I hope you have a cup of tea.
I'm pounding the tea.
Have your lovely wife, Carmel, get up and get you some tea. I work with Carmel. That's how I can say this. Yeah, like fetch your slippers right out of... she'll get me tomorrow. She'll get me tomorrow. I am keeping under-the-weather Jim DeRogatis on the phone for another 20 minutes or so because I cannot... rave enough about his book Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly. It is really a book about Chicago and journalism and crime and punishment. Jim writes in the book, Jim is not from here, but he writes, I had never loved a city, any city, as much as Chicago. I enjoyed living in Minneapolis twice, but it truly is a small town and one where some restaurants at the time thought egg noodles and ketchup were pasta. Chicago was special. Then he writes in that same page, through the mid, after extolling many things about Chicago, except for its pizza, he's New York all the way on that. Through the mid-90s, I continued to follow R. Kelly's burgeoning career with the pride of a hometown journalist and critic who'd been there almost at the start, as well as, I'll admit, a fan, albeit one with reservations. We flip forward a few years in Jim's life and career. He and Abdon Palish have been teamed together for what will eventually be 33, I think, 30-something byline stories together. Here's how it starts. After 4 weeks of 16-hour days working through weekends and juggling the emotionally draining Kelly reporting with our regular assignments, Abdon and I felt exhausted but wired. We were frustrated by the angles we hadn't nailed, yet confident of a lead we'd spent more time crafting, a lead being the beginning of a story for you, the non-journalists out there, lead we'd spent more time crafting under more scrutinizing eyes than the first paragraph of any other story either of us had ever written. Here is that lead as it appeared in the Sun-Times. Chicago singer and songwriter R. Kelly used his position of fame and influence as a pop superstar to meet girls as young as 15 and have sex with them, according to court records and interviews. Abdon and Jim then went down to the Billy Goat, a place that Jim incomprehensibly doesn't like as much as Abdon or I do. But
yes.
And you expected a different kind of reaction to that story than you got, did you not?
We would never have thought that 19 years later this would be ongoing until the feds finally moved. You know, we thought we nailed him, Rick.
Yep, I know.
We had so much on the record and in court papers, information that had been sealed by courts but given to me. You know, I never thought I'd still be on this in the summer of 2017 when it turned out he was living with six women in what their relatives called a cult, that they were brainwashed. You know,
one of the great ironies, Jim, one of the great ironies in this, I don't remember if you brought it up in the book, that you know, he also, his apartment in Trump Tower,
yes,
which is like 30-some floors above where you got that fax, the first fax. That haunts me forever. That's where the Sun-Times building was.
Where the Sun-Times was. That's where I watched the video.
Yeah.
Of him sexually assaulting, urinating in the mouth of a 14-year-old girl with that girl's aunt.
Yeah.
You know, he's pathological. He returns to the same places again and again and again. Kenwood Academy, the Rock and Roll McDonald's, where, you know, he got out of jail a couple of months ago on the Illinois charges,
right,
and went to the new green McDonald's that was the Rock and Roll McDonald's.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
You know, when he left home, he was staying at the Y in the South Loop, and he would busk on the streets, and then it was converted to luxury condos, and he bought the
penthouse. That was his first condo.
First home, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird sort of pathology. You see this with you know, not to be melodramatic, but you see it with, like, you know, Charles Manson and the Green River Killer.
Yep.
You know, there's these, yeah, these praying grounds. And, you know, none of this was secret in Chicago. And I got to say, cops on the beat knew this. They knew to watch for him at the Rock and Roll McDonald's at Evergreen Plaza in front of Kenwood. The investigation was already a year and a half or 2 years old when we did our first story in December 2000.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of people of conscience. The prosecutors, Shauna Bolliker, who's now on the bench, Bob Hagesheimer, who's retired, the investigators, Dan Everett and several others, they wanted to stop this. I think they lacked an asset that we had as reporters. You know, there is a justifiable suspicion in the black community of law enforcement, and it was much less threatening talking to two reporters.
Absolutely.
Even two unlikely white reporters,
yeah,
a fat white rock critic, and a little Irish Polish leprechaun,
right,
which is what Abden's
and which Abden likes it. Abden likes it when you call him that. That's
yes,
a great
he gets
thing.
A kick out of that. My editor was very concerned that he'd be offending it. It's like, no.
One of the most dramatic parts of the book for me, Jim, revolves around that VHS tape when, you know, you might have been arrested. Judge Gaughan, that horrible person, announced that I'd be arrested if I did not appear for him at before 10 in the morning that night. Sometimes music editor Tom Conner called my wife Carmel and told her she shouldn't answer the door at home for anyone. That was a real debate at the paper, was it not?
Oh, it was significant because Gaughan had thrown several people in jail for contempt of court.
Yeah.
A mentally disturbed woman who had, you know, shouted free R. Kelly. He threw her in jail. He threatened Kelly's crisis manager with jail for violating his gag order. And he was furious that the Sun-Times would not produce me. And the reason we wouldn't is it was going to put serious damage to the reporter's privilege, the Illinois Shield
Law.
Oh,
absolutely, sure.
You know, and I was, you know, I was not going to name any of the people who had spoken to me in confidentiality.
Of course not.
For the best reason any whistleblower does. We now see it in the federal indictment, that physical harm was threatened to them by Kelly's people. You know, then there was the highfalutin journalistic ethics of it. It's going to set bad precedent. And, you know, the deadline that every other paper that reported that day when I took the Fifth Amendment on the stand in Gaughan's courtroom, that I took the Fifth and cited the First Amendment, even though Gaughan was not recognizing that. The Tribune just reported I took the Fifth.
Yeah.
I succeeded in getting Anne-Marie Lipinski to run a correction.
I remember that.
Because I did that for every journalist in Chicago.
Of course.
You know, and Gaughan tried the same thing. He presided over the shooting trial of Laquan McDonald.
Yeah.
And he was upbraided that time by, you know, for sealing the records, gag orders, all this stuff, was upbraided by the Illinois Supreme Court for constitutionally unacceptable behavior. And, you know, it's high time that man is removed from the bench. And you know, he's been a stain on Chicago, and he's not the only one.
Yep.
The defense attorneys, you know, one of whom is Sam Adam Jr. You've been on 90 lately?
Oh, yeah, you said big billboards.
Huge billboards. Sam will fight for you. You know, his partner, Ed Jensen, the senior attorney on that team, they were all making $850 an hour for 6.5 years, gave an interview to Neil Steinberg of the Sun-Times just 2 months ago and said, we all knew Kelly was guilty as hell.
It was like the old lawyer. He's coming clean finally. Yeah.
Now, how do you look at yourself in the mirror
when
you have babies and you have grandchildren and you know what he's done to these young black women and you know he's guilty? You know, and you game the system through bribery and intimidation of witnesses. Kelly's gaming the system. To what extent are those attorneys culpable?
Yeah.
To what extent was Judge Vincent Gaughan culpable?
Sure.
There were literally thousands of people in Chicago, from the lowly guy who ran the tape recorders at the studio to, you know, the guy who would book his gym, his high-end court at the high-end gym, and to the managers, the accountants, the lawyers. You know, everybody turned a blind eye for 30 years because the first victim is 1991.
Well, fame and money.
Documented victim.
It just what your book reaffirmed for me is the. And it's how fame combined with money combined with sociological troubles can really be a huge kind of blanket and an insulation. We got to take one more break and then I'll take you all the way to the top of the hour. I have a million questions about this book because I obviously admire tremendously Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly. I want to mention a couple of heroes. We've mentioned a couple of the terrible villains in here, but there are people aside from Jim and Abdon Palish who are heroic in this whole thing. Will be right back. There are many, many villains in the book Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, minor and major. There are also great heroes. Jim DeRogatis doesn't like to be regarded as such, but he is. So is his colleague Abdon Palish. And so is, sort of forgotten in this whole thing, Mary Mitchell, who is African-American and who was... one of your strongest allies, especially when you were confronted with not so much abuse, but troubles with the African-American community, wasn't she?
Yeah, when people were calling us racist,
yeah.
Mary wrote something like 36 columns in the first couple of years screaming at her community that there was a predator in its midst. And, you know, we were not two white guys trying to bring down a black superstar.
Right.
We were trying to stop this man preying on their daughters.
Yeah.
And, you know, but whether it was Jesse Jackson and the Operation Push people or
the Pitchfork, you know, people who put him on
the stick. Pitchfork people.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was this willful ignoral of people being hurt.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people keep wanting to ask me, are you aggrieved in any way that the six-hour docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, which aired in January,
right,
it took that to prompt action. And I tell you, Rick, this goes against every grain in my body and yours. Reporters do not like to be scooped.
Of course not.
But on this story, yep, me, Abdon, Mary Mitchell, we never felt proprietary.
Of course
we
not.
Kept thinking, everybody should be writing about this. Where is the Chicago Tribune? Where are the big out-of-town magazines? Where is Rolling Stone? Where is Billboard? Everybody should be writing
even
about this.
Where, you know, where is Frontline? Where's 2020? Where's, you know, the potent TV? Again,
well, I remember Dateline did an interview with Abdon and me, but they had gotten a Kelly interview.
Right.
So they were exceedingly slanted against
of
us.
Of course.
And,
well, because they got the,
like,
big star, man. They got the big star. Again, Jim dedicates his book for the girls. Jim, I've got to believe this book might have been a hard sell to publishers.
Yeah,
as good as it is, and I think this thing.
You want to hear something horrifying? There were two people in all of publishing in New York who were interested. One is a woman named Amy Hundley, who works at Grove Atlantic, who went to Kenwood Academy.
So she has a personal connection to
personal
story.
Connection yeah. to this horror, and she grew up reading me and listening to me. The other, Jameson Stoltz, grew up in Oak Park, went to Oak Park, River Forest High, where the girl in the video
right,
went.
Right.
He grew up reading and listening to me. That's it. That's who, all of who was interested. You know, now Jameson has edited Gay Talese and Mark Bowden, you know, and he saw it as a work of literary journalism.
Let's I agree.
Try to tell a story that is bigger than this guy. And you know, that's the only thing that got me to live with this ugliness. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not over, I'm sure. You know, the horrible things that are going to come out.
I can't even imagine. That may be
in the trial, but he's never going to breathe fresh air again. So it really
good. So the bottom line is good. I also have to believe that people may start to think of this book like, ooh, God, R. Kelly. That is not what this book is about. This book is kind of a detective story. It is about so many other things. It is so also about Chicago and these sort of precarious way in which we, the races, live here. Yeah. I think it's like...
Well, and you know, and I think above and beyond that, you know, you got to remember, Rick, I'm a music critic.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Roger Ebert, a mutual friend of ours, a mentor, a colleague for 15 years at Sun-Times, and Lester Bangs. Those two paradigms for me of how much art means in the world and how important it is and how we have to confront it, you know, vehemently when it espouses false ideals, whether it's triumph of the will. I mean, this conversation I had with Roger about that Nazi propaganda film, or Lester, you know, believing in the core of his being, as I do, that, that music can save your life.
Sure.
Well, is there a flip side? Can it also be the ultimate tool to corrupt and ruin lives? And that's what we've seen with Kelly,
obviously,
you know, it's so yeah. I mean, we get to the very nature of. I got to sit the day the book was published in New York at a public radio thing with Tarana Burke, who launched hashtag MeToo in the Bronx in 2006, and it struck me, Rick. I am sitting with this woman. This must be what it would have been like to sit with Dr. King or Malcolm X in 1964.
Yeah.
In terms of the worldwide civil rights conversation and revolution she has started. And, you know, it's long overdue. It's the entire history of humanity overdue.
Oh, of course.
And boy, the fight has not been won. It wasn't, you know, wasn't won when, you know, Anita Hill testified, and it wasn't one when Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified, you know.
It's
and we
long,
have someone in the White House who brags of grabbing them by
things.
The you-know.
Yeah.
Right? No. You know, but it needs to be had, and what is left for people like you and me who care about music and art and literature is, can we separate the art and the artist? Should we? And I think 99% of the time we can, because, you know, there would be no art if we'd only accept art from perfect
people. Perfect
people.
But there are no perfect,
you know,
people. I mean, you have
Woody
done...
Woody Allen, you know, Michael Jackson, R. Kelly. You know, this is going to be troublesome for decades to come.
No kidding. You have done, Jim DeRogatis, you know how much I admire your work, but this thing is really over the top. Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. I've read it twice. I will read it again one of these days because it is.
Well, I hope we get to sit one of these days, Rick, in a journalism symposium.
I'd love to, Jim.
You know, teaching at Columbia and seeing, you know, was one of my students, Mina Bloom.
I know.
Who broke the alligator story.
I should actually enroll in Columbia. I never went to college, I'd love to have you as a professor. Jim, it's a remarkable book. Please feel better. Please write another book, will you?
I'm going to write something much more fun next time, yes.
I can't imagine what kind of toll this was to live with it and to write it. And you could not, I would not change a word in this book. Soulless,
well, thank you,
Rick. Case Against R. Kelly by Jim DeRogatis. It's remarkable work, and it should be on the shelf of anybody who cares about Chicago. And it's also incredibly readable, even though there's some icky stuff in it, as they say. Life can be icky. Jim, sweet dreams.
Thank you, Rick. We'll
talk
soon.
Take care.
Bye.
It's quite a book. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Earl Coleman, thanks for producing. Dan, thanks for engineering.